Hi everyone, welcome to Chinese Whispers. This is where we demystify the People's Republic of China. We are Amal and...
I'm Jyotsna.
We are foreign policy enthusiasts interested in understanding China. And also we are consulting editors for the Kootneeti, which is a Delhi-based publication covering strategic affairs. So you might want to ask, why are we doing this? Why are two people with actually very different backgrounds trying to do a podcast on China? So I believe there are four reasons for that. First of all, Indians trying to understand China is quite like six blind men trying to figure out what an elephant is. I mean, is it really a communist country? Is it really a capitalist country? We can't really agree on that yet. Or is it a benevolent country because it raised so many people out of poverty, gave them wealth? Or is it a malignant country? That is it bad for people given that it crushes human rights? And also, we have seen a narrative of, oh, hey, how can you trust America? We better trust our Asian brothers. But on the other hand, we also see that, hey, let's build an Asian century. And, you know, the old saying, Hindi chini bhai bhai, which did not actually work out in history. So that's why for us Indians, we need to understand China very well. You know, the last time we misunderstood China, 1962 was the year, and you know, nothing happened in that year, right, Jyotsna?
Yeah, you're very right, you know. But there are two more reasons to this. So as China becomes more aggressive and more assertive and starts gaining greater influence in our near and our extended neighborhood, I think it's all the more important that we do not make the same mistakes of misjudging China. And why is China misunderstood? Well, that's because the only party that ever rules China now, which is the Communist Party of China, it is great at mixed signals and deception. You know, they throw around this language of, oh, let's build an Asian century together. But hey, we'll be the one leading it. Let's build a new era of for shared future of humanity. Again, we'll be the one leading it. Oh, it's all about brotherhood and don't believe in Western propaganda. So it's very important that we are able to look beyond this great wall of disinformation that the CCP has erected. So for today, our agenda would be to kind of imagine how it would be to live under a party like the Communist Party of China. And then we'll briefly discuss the power structure of the CCP. How does the CCP gain its power, and how is it designed to manufacture that kind of authority that it exercises? And then we'll go on to talk about the narratives that the CCP has used over the years.
But Jyotsna, we are talking about the country, not the party, right? So why are we deciding to talk about the Communist Party, first of all, in our first ever episode?
Because, Amal, we can't talk about the People's Republic of China without talking about the CCP. Because PRC is equal to CCP. Or at least, that is what the party wants. And that is how the party has built the state of China.
Yeah, that's unfortunately true, despite how much I dislike that system. But yeah, it's the system that oversees, controls, governs, and essentially keeps all of China together. And also defines what it is. And if you just have to happen, you know, if you just happen to have a different opinion on this, you might get punished. And if you have anything or anybody in China, you have to get your power or your legitimacy from the CCP. There's no way you can escape that.
Yeah. But imagine putting through our listeners for the first episode of our podcast to listen to how the political party is structured. That would be very dull, so drab, you know.
Yeah.
So we thought that we'd probably imagine India if it were like China, modern day China. What if the BJP were like the CCP? You know, let's imagine, say, a People's Republic of India.
I'm so glad. I used to hate civics. Yeah, it's kind of scary, but at least this is a much more interesting way than just describing, oh, this is how the CCP functions and blah, blah, blah.
But you know what? A lot of people would say, oh, well, you know, India has become like PRC. So let's see whether it has really become like PRC, or are we stretching our imagination too much to read reality in India these days?
Yep, let's go for it then. So first of all, in the PRI, the People's Republic of India, BJP would be the only political party. That is, no Congress, no Shiv Sena, no Samajwadi Party, no Aam Aadmi Party, nothing. Mm-hmm. You won't get the chance to vote. BJP members within themselves, they might vote depending on the context. And whenever outsiders question BJP that, hey, you're being a very dictatorial society, a dictatorial party, they'll just say, hey, look, this was the last time some voting happened in us. Therefore, we are a democracy. Which
look, we voted for each other.
Yeah, we voted for each other. We just, you know, practiced some form of a voting procedure. Therefore, we are automatically a democracy. And yeah, this has happened, by the way. So,
democracy with Indian characteristics.
Yes.
Let's just call it that.
Democracy with Indian characteristics with, you know, 5,000 years of culture behind us and the great Indian system. So, yeah, I mean, in this process, BJP won't be accountable to pretty much anybody. There will be no way of voting it out. Like right now, you may or may not like the BJP, but if you dislike it, you can vote against it. And yeah, even while the BJP is in power, you still have the right to go and protest, which in PRI, you may not have the right. I mean, you may technically be able to protest, but the consequences are better left unsaid. And that gets us to the recent protests over the Citizenship Amendment Act. These protests would not actually be possible because A, your protest, first of all, will not be covered if you manage to come across or rather get to the streets. Nobody else will get to know that you're protesting. B, you might be just thrashed publicly by the Chengu, or I forgot the name of the specific type of anti-protest police they have. And finally, the extreme ones might be sent to re-education camps or might just be executed in the end for simply exercising the right to protest. And yeah, so this is the reality. Within CCP, elections may or may not happen. Protests are blocked out many a time, especially in Hong Kong's case, where they can't really block the protests. They infiltrate, they manufacture. We'll cover that in a later episode. The laws within mainland China are defined by the party, and most of the time they are in the interest of the party, or actually almost all the time. People don't really have a say for their own rights and freedoms. The party functions like a simple bureaucratic system. Imagine the IS without any electoral oversight, and also with huge dollops of nepotism.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of accountability, there is no way you could voice your opposition. You know, there's one thing to throw parties out of power. But here in India, India is one of these countries which has the largest number of social media users. But in PRI, social media would be homemade. That means controlled by the government. And even the internet would be homemade. So what that means is that there's no way of reporting information, say, from what's happening on the ground at the Citizenship Amendment Act protest that you're attending. All that you get on this homemade social media is fake propaganda, which has been spread by the BJP. And that's about it, to build a certain narrative. You know, there's another thing. Then there's no way that fakes could be spread from groups that have vested interests, say fabricated videos of provocative speeches that would show the state in bad light. So only one section of the society, which is the ruling elite, the BJP, would have absolute control over the narrative.
Well, don't you think they are the most benevolent and the nicest people you can come across, who only have your good interests inside with their glorious history, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, if they're not there, you know, the Japanese might come back.
Yeah.
And, you know, social media is one thing, but even the traditional media, would be completely under the control of the BJP in a PRI sort of a state. So there would be no wire, there'd be no caravan, even the Hindu wouldn't be there. And let alone these, you know, left-wing outlets. Even Arnab Goswami could be thrown in jail or in a re-education camp if he manages to say something slightly unsavory. And guess what? Something like this has actually happened in China. So we had the Xinhua News Agency, and a lot of you know that. That's the party mouthpiece, essentially. So a few reporters from Xinhua said minorly unfavorable things about the government. And they were abducted in the middle of their live news telecast. Imagine that. And of course, as many of you know, social media and the internet is pretty much made in China. There is complete monitoring of your online activity. And, you know, we're not just talking about regular monitoring that, you know, that say most of us probably are aware of in even other societies. But this is a society, say, that bans words like disagree, constitutional amendments, emigration, emperor, when, you know, Xi Jinping elects himself as ruler for life. Because, you know, you might say, oh, I'll emigrate to South Korea. Emigrate? You're off internet and your social credit score plummets, because that's a word which is so anti-national.
Imagine if when Narendra Modi became the prime minister in 2019, imagine the word emigration and constitution being banned from social media. Just imagine that.
Yeah. Wow. Or even the word disagree. So you can't say, Mom, I disagree that you're cooking palak paneer today, you know, because you'd get thrown out of the country for saying something like this.
Yeah. Oh, the world we live in. But anyway, so now what about the judiciary? Right. We know that the judiciary, I mean, we have typically grown up to see the judiciary as the impartial body which delivers justice as much as it can. In fact, recently, the Ayodhya verdict has been a long-awaited output of the Supreme Court, which the BJP, as far as we understand, was also desperately waiting for. But in the PRI, the Supreme Court would be waiting for the BJP's verdict on matters like this. Mm-hmm. Let me say that again. In the PRI, the Supreme Court would be waiting for the BJP's verdict on Ayodhya. It's like, hey, the Supreme Court reaches out to BJP. Hey, do you think we should give a judgment like this? I hope you won't feel bad about it and stuff like that. Just imagine that happening. Only in PRI. But no, that's... yeah, and that's the reality that in the People's Republic of China, the Supreme Court itself has said that it is not at all independent and it is proud of it. Let's say that again. The Supreme Court in PRC, the People's Republic of China, has said that it is not independent. It is completely dependent on the interests of the Communist Party to make judgments. And then is proud of it because, you know, why have an independent judiciary? Such a Western foreign idea, isn't it, Jyotsna?
Yeah, impartiality itself is a Western idea. So the only people who can be right on any issue are the ruling BJP. That's it.
Yeah, of course.
And you know what? In a PRI, there wouldn't be a verdict on the Ayodhya.
Why?
In a PRI, the BJP, which is often accused in, you know, in this real world of trying to build a Hindu Rashtra and pushing forward a supremacist Hindu agenda, they would not be interested in religion. In fact, they would be dismantling religion because they would want your complete devotion. BJP would be the religion.
Okay.
Your loyalty to Lord Ram or Lord Krishna or Allah or whoever would be dangerous to the BJP's Politburo.
Okay, hang on. So in the PRI, BJP, which is typically known for, I mean, or rather accused of, you know, harking to religious figures like non-human characters and talking about them a lot, will actually be destroying those ideas and will get you to worship their real human beings?
Yeah, because religion can be a dangerous idea when because it tries to create power centers. So, you know, there's a power center for Allah, there's a power center for Jesus, and then there's a power center for Krishna. But in a PRI, the only power center would be the power center of the BJP. Just like how in China, Buddhism, there's been a crackdown on Buddhism, which has, say, given way to Mao worshipping. So we have shrines of Mao where the Communist Party members, they gather and they burn incense sticks and they offer offer money and paper offerings and then kneel and worship and prostrate in front of the statue of Mao Zedong. temples and churches.
Yeah, can we have temples? Yeah, can we have temples for Shyama Prasad Mukherjee possibly? That'll be awesome.
You'll have to ask Modi.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this was happening in the Cultural Revolution. It continues to happen now. So there is, like Bitter Winter has reported, there's an active campaign, say, to exterminate Buddhism and worship, say, the celestial deity Buddha Mao Zedong. Traditional yin-yang signs, which everyone knows, are now giving way to Communist Party symbols in temples, these communist temples.
Wow.
And in fact, in 2015, China legalized the sinicization of religion. What this means is that you make religion compatible to Chinese Communist Party's objectives. This means you, Dalai Lama cannot reincarnate without intervention by the party. This means that Islam has to be compatible with the CCP, and there have to be CCP cells in Buddhist temples and in churches.
Yeah, the officially atheist Communist Party is dictating religion. Wonderful, because yeah. Hey, you know, I mean, it goes back to say that God is an atheist. These people. But anyway, moving on. What about the Bhakts? Remember the Bhakts? Oftentimes, they're not looked at as favorable people. They are often looked at as social media trolls, etc. And it's often...
IT cell.
Yeah, IT cell people. It's often a cuss word. And but in PRI, Bhakts would be the star citizens. They would be the most loyal people of the BJP with very high social credit scores. They would be, you know, like loved by BJP left, right and center. In fact, in the 1950s, the Bhakts of the CCP, that is the people in a way who had a lot of troubles in their lives, who had some issues with the society, they were encouraged to get out, to get into people's homes, call them as counter-revolutionaries, pick them up, maybe kill them and take away all their property. That could happen to you if you were living in PRI. Watch out for the next Bhakt to come in and confiscate all your property and maybe even just kill you on the side because,
this,
you know.
This, you know, this mm-hmm. almost makes me want to be called a Bhakt on internet now.
But wait, there's a plot twist, Jyotsna. That,
really?
Yeah, there's a major plot twist that if there are too many Bhakts like you, then, you know, it just might happen that many of you would start saying, hey, we are the real power seekers here, so we might just push BJP aside. But in that context, then BJP would start targeting you as your numbers will be rising. So the idea is that, you know, CCP did that actually later on. That targeted the people who became a power center among in themselves.
Yeah, so what you're really talking about and what we've talked about so far is that essentially the prime motive of the BJP in a PRI would be to maintain power at all costs and at all times. And, you know, even if this means killing a bunch of people to safeguard your hold over this power, and obviously that not a lot of people, 9 crore people maybe indirectly and about 1 crore directly, your military's primary threat wouldn't come from outside your borders, but from within the PRI.
Wait, hang on.
So essentially,
that's about 10% of the population.
Like, yes, really? But you know, these people, they could be funded by the CIA. 10% of the population could be CIA agents. You never know.
Interesting. That, yeah. I wonder what CIA's budget is, but okay. Interesting.
you know, this actually happened during the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward, when about 1 crore people were directly killed and 9 crore were indirectly killed.
Interesting. Yeah, mm-hmm. And that might make you think, like, what exactly was the military doing then? Wasn't its job to protect the people that when so many people were dying? But surprise, surprise, the military's job is not to protect the people. Its job is, in this PRI, is to protect the power of the BJP. That is, it is just the armed wing of the BJP and not the National Army. So its reason for existence is to keep the BJP in power and not to protect you from external enemies. So for example, let's say there's a war with Pakistan going on and there's a large protest going on in Uttar Pradesh that people are saying, hey, we have a problem with food prices or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The BJP in PRI would actually be sending more of the military to crush the people in Uttar Pradesh than to fight Pakistani soldiers.
Wow.
Let that sink in.
Well, India.
Of course, India.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised. I actually remember seeing a recruiting video of the PLA. Don't ask me why, but yeah, I saw this. And what it showed was that, you know, hey, come join the military, come join the PLA, and you get to shoot your own people, you get to shoot protesters. That is what they showed in the video, that the army was practicing to shoot protesters in China.
Yeah, what a wonderful reason to join the army.
Yeah,
I mean,
but yeah, you know, your freedoms, you think you can say whatever you want from the comfort of your own classrooms or your homes. I don't think that would be possible in PRI. There will be an aggressive network of spies all around you. This could be anyone, your teachers, your parents, your friends, who could report you. And in fact, even your phone. And at the other end of all this, who's listening to this? The spying organizations whose budget would be much larger than the military's budget. Imagine that. This brings us back to your point, Amal, that the primary threat comes from within the borders, because the military is the wing of the party and whose objective is to maintain the power of the party.
Yep,
and that is what would be happening, from companies to your best friends, institutions. Everyone would be mandated by law to pass any kind of information that the party might think would be harmful to national interests. All of this would go and would directly impact you, because your social credit score would go down, and then, you know, you can't buy land or gas, or you can't renew your passport.
Jyotsna, I just hope you're not going to report me. I just hope, in this PRI.
You're a very nice national friend of mine. I wouldn't say anything, yeah.
Oh, that's cute. But okay.
As long as, you know, you prove yourself as a bhakt that is not going to supersede authority.
Yes, totally. I'm forever loyal.
Yeah.
But yes. Yeah, so to our listeners, if you're scared and shocked in disbelief, I hate to break it to you, this is exactly how China operates.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the power structure of the party itself and see how exactly the design of the party helps the party gain the kind of power and hold this power that it does already. So imagine the CCP as a large impenetrable system that exercises authority over all aspects of social life of the People's Republic. And here, the party executive, or the party general secretary, would be at the very center. He would be the one who has the most control. He's the most important entity here. And right now, that is Xi Jinping. So Xi sits on top of the Politburo Standing Committee, which is a group of very few men mostly.
Always, yeah. Not mostly.
Always, yes. Well, I hope Justin Trudeau is not listening to the podcast. But anyway, and the Politburo Standing Committee itself gets chosen out of the Politburo. So these people form the most important decision makers within the Communist Party of China. And they also hold parallel positions in the state. So what I mean to say here is that Xi Jinping, while being the general secretary of the party, would also be the president of China, the president of PRC. And, you know, this kind of parallel system, it goes all the way down to the village level. So other members of the Politburo Standing Committee would hold, say, positions of ministers in PRC. There is no other way. The equation of PRC equals CCP is literally enshrined and built into the system. So the only way you can become the president or the premier or a minister in PRC is by taking higher positions in the CCP. If you, even if you want to become, say, you know, your village head, you will have to make sure that you're the topmost person in the Communist Party cell of your village. And that also that happens even within institutions and not just, you know, say, government positions. So if you have to head a certain institution, you have to make sure that there are Communist Party cells and you're at the very top of those.
You know, this just makes me sad that Xi Jinping at the top, poor Winnie the Pooh, he has taken up so much responsibility for himself.
Oh, I'll have to report you now. Okay. You just insulted the dignity of Asia's greatest leader ever.
Come on, yeah. Winnie the Pooh is cute. I like it.
But he's not strong. He's not going to give it back to the Americans.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, if Xi Jinping has a problem with Winnie the Pooh, his problem, I guess. But okay, yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder how what narratives have helped the CCP maintain their hold over power. And Amal, maybe you could enlighten us about that.
Sure. So the basic problem with any form of a dictatorial governance system is that people's interests are not all that cared for. So what you often have to do as the power holder is that you have to create some sort of a narrative to explain and justify what you're doing. So the CCP's narrative has actually changed over time a lot. So for that, let us make one thing very, very clear that CCP is not really a communist party. It is just a group of power grabbers slash power holders who change the narrative over and over to maintain power. For example, when Mao Zedong came to power in 1949, or actually slightly before that also, China was largely a divided country. In a feudal society, his interest was to make it all an imperial system where his party owns everything and controls everything. So his narrative was, oh, the greatness of the country, or the greatness of China, and then a bunch of other socialism and communism related ideas. For example, the People's Republic, he called it. So for the People's Republic, in reality, people don't mean anything. They just get into communes, etc. That was the narrative which Mao Zedong put across. Secondly, then with this attitude, they actually hit a financial crisis in the 1970s. So Deng Xiaoping, when he became the main core leader back in the days, he thought, okay, let's change this to something else so that we can have some sort of a financial, like we can increase our power using money. So they started a setup of the liberalization policy. And for that, the CCP developed the narrative of, hey, if you trust us to rule over you, we will continually deliver prosperity to you. So it's often known as the continual delivery of prosperity to people. So that has been going on since the 1980s, if I remember correctly. And that sort of stopped when Xi Jinping came to power, or roughly around that, slightly before that. That was because, hey, the financial growth has actually stopped. People's lives are not improving as much. So people are asking questions about their rights, etc.
Yeah.
Yep. Which is why Xi Jinping has now started this nationalism and this socialism drama again. Notice that he doesn't talk about communism, because communism died a long time ago. But he's still talking about socialism and nationalism. Socialism. Yeah. And that's how he's trying to, you know, maintain power in China.
Yeah. Yeah, you always need grand ideas and grand narratives to mobilize people.
Absolutely.
I wonder what grand narrative we could use to increase our following and listeners here on Chinese Whispers. But anyway, that's all for today, folks. I think we should create an enemy and then, you know, use the us versus them narrative.
Well, yes. Oh, trust me. We have a lot of enemies.
So that's all for today, guys. For our next episode, of course, we will be paying our due respects to the one true leader of the Asian century we're all looking forward to building.
Oh, our Winnie the Pooh. Awesome.
Yes. Chairman Xi Jinping, or, you know, you could also call him Gyara Jinping, as he's known in India.
Yeah.
We will talk about how he has fashioned the party, how he has consolidated his power and that of the PRC with respect to other countries, mainly the US, but also other major powers.
Awesome. Awesome. And to our listeners, do send us your feedback and comments. We would be linking our Twitter below in the description. And also feel free to send us questions that you would like to see addressed, any curiosities, etc. about China. And also, if you like this podcast, do share the link and subscribe to our channel. So until next time, see you and thank you.